Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus, global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Okay, now to more on that blowout jobs report. In case you missed all the details, payrolls in the U.S. in March rose by the most in nearly a year. The unemployment rate dropped, pointing to a strong labor market powering the economy. 303,000 last month, that's the number for non-farm payrolls increasing. It followed a combined 22,000 upward revision to job gains in the prior 2 months, this all from the BLS.
All right, and then we also had the unemployment falling to 3.8% with more people joining the workforce and able to find a job. As we mentioned in our last chat, Treasury yields too have moved up and expectations around Fed rate cuts continue to be pushed out. Or if we didn't mention it, we should have, but so we did mention it. So let's get to it with our roundtable. Bloomberg News economics editor Molly Smith right here in studio, and then Bloomberg Intelligence chief U.S. interest rate strategist Ira Jersey at BI headquarters in Princeton, New Jersey. I want to go, Molly, first of all, blowout, robust, some of the words we've been using here at Bloomberg, if you read through some of the stories on the Bloomberg.
You didn't say Goldilocks.
I didn't, but I'm going to leave it for these guys to make that conclusion. Where is the strength, and why did this surprise so much to the upside? What was it that maybe our surveys missed?
I feel like we wonder this every month, right? I mean, where isn't there a month where the jobs report is massively surprising
to
the upside?
So what are we missing? Why is it that economists are much more tepid when about it?
I think this is still what a lot of people are debating, and I think, you know, I talked about this maybe not on your show yesterday, but with Joe Matthew on Balance of Power, that a lot of people are still really trying to get their head around the impact that immigration is playing in
talked
the
about
jobs
it too.
Figures.
Yeah, Rich Moore had a great piece on this yesterday, and we had him on our program.
Great,
yeah.
Yes. I worked with Rich on that story, and this is where we actually were wondering this a bit more coming out of today as well, because there are these two different measures of employment within the jobs report. Obviously, the main one we look at is that big payrolls figure, the 303,000. That one comes from a survey of businesses. These are like big companies. You know, they're like a smaller margin of error. It's a really big survey. There's a smaller survey of households, and this measures people rather than jobs. So it's a smaller survey. It has a larger margin of error, but this might be where more economists think the immigration impact will show up, because this is people reporting actual jobs rather than large companies where immigrants are likely not to be employed at. So it's something that we're going to have to look at going forward. It's unclear whether that played a role in today's report, but something that definitely going forward is the idea this is going to boost the underlying pace of job growth.
Before we go to Ira, just real quickly, any weakness in the data today?
Oh, man. I mean, I think, you know, if you talk to the average American worker, the slowdown in wages, obviously not what they want to see. Great for the Fed, not for someone
great
who's
for
actually
companies who are worried about their margins.
Right, of course, but not great for someone who is receiving a smaller paycheck.
Fair.
Hey, Ira Jersey, come on in here, because you're chief interest rate strategist over at Bloomberg Intelligence.
And we
you've
like
been
you.
Watching, we like you too. And you've been watching what's been going on with rates throughout the day, especially after this number crossed at 8:30 this morning. We're seeing yields higher across the curve. What jumps out to you?
Yeah, so we're actually, yields aren't that much higher than they were right before the number. A little bit on the 10-year, about 2 basis points and maybe 3.5 basis points or so in the front end. So you're seeing a little bit of bear flattening of the yield curve once again. You know, the market's doing pretty much what you would expect on an on-hold Fed and a Federal Reserve that wasn't going to cut before July at this point. And so I would suspect that you'd wind up continuing to see the front end sell off just a little bit more, particularly if we have a decent, you know, 0.3, 0.4 CPI print next week, because, you know, that's just going to solidify the idea that the Fed's not likely to go even in June. And you know, once you take June completely off the board, then two-year yields probably have to creep up at least a handful more basis points in order to make it a fair value.
Why, Ira, do you think that we're not seeing yields higher at the front end of the curve, given that rate cut expectations have been pushed out further?
Well, we're closest to the highest level we've been in many months, actually, in about 6 months now in the front end of the curve. So the market is still thinking that the Federal Reserve is going to cut. So you think about what the two-year yield is, right? The two-year yield is theoretically just the average of what the overnight rate's going to be over the next 2 years. And the market still thinks at some point the Federal Reserve is going to cut interest rates. And it's very possible, and actually I think this is actually a more likely scenario than some others that people have expressed, is that the Federal Reserve may be on hold, say, until very late in this year, maybe even early next year. But then once they start cutting, they end up cutting very significantly, like 200 basis points. Mm. So if you take the average of all of those outcomes, you end up getting something like 4.85% on the two-year note. And so you know, we're not that far from there in terms of current pricing. So I think that's important. I will say one thing, though. When you look at the wage data, one of the issues that you have to consider is the totality of the aggregate paycheck of the economy and the overall labor force. So even though wage growth slowed, people are still getting wage increases. On top of that, hours worked was up and you had the decent payroll number. So there's still a lot more money in the private economy right now than there was than there has been before. Because of that, things like the increase in oil prices and the like, yes, that will be a bit of a drag on the economy, but it won't be as much of a drag because incomes in aggregate are just a little tiny bit higher and high enough to offset some of those higher costs for the household sector.
Right. We talked this week about the increases out in California, but even overall how minimum wages across the country have gone up. So, Molly, as you look at this data and think about what's to come and the Fed speak that we've gotten, I feel like once again, Tim and I were talking in the newsroom that even this idea that we could get a Fed rate increase if warranted.
If
the Fed is data dependent, as Ira reminds us, right, and others, like if you're data dependent, if the data warrants it, the Fed's going to do it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's, I say scary thought, like kind of jokingly, but no, it is true. I mean, it's like right now when you're looking for what are convincing signs that the economy is slowing down and that inflation is sustainably moving to 2%. Well, right now we've seen inflation really more moving sideways than anything. I wouldn't necessarily say moving up, but sideways,
right,
which is not down.
Not going more, right,
not
exactly.
Really more down. And of course, the labor market's still being very much an up arrow. Consumer spending still an up arrow. It's still very much a strong economy. And I think, you know, the Fed has obviously set a really high bar if they were going to hike again. And you'd have to imagine that there would have to be a lot more telegraphing that kind of a move would come. Because right now the expectation is hold, hold, hold. We don't have the evidence right now or the confidence level that we are moving sustainably to 2% to cut. So that would be a real market shift in what we hear from policymakers if they are considering a hike.
Ira, if that, you know, how would that eventually, if indeed something like that becomes a kind of a more stronger beat, if you will, drum beat, this idea that we could actually get a rate increase, what would you anticipate in terms of U.S. Treasury curves? And I am curious if you even think that that's a possibility this year.
So, well, I'm not sure that it's a realistic possibility this year. I mean, it's not, you know, completely out of the question, but that would be a massive tail risk. I think it's, you know, but what a realistic scenario might be is that the economy is strong enough that the Fed feels it can't cut and therefore it keeps rates where they are maybe into next year. And actually, when you look at what's being priced into the market, options on SOFR futures right now, so short-term interest rate futures that move are very, very closely with what the Federal Reserve is going to to do. It's actually pricing almost a 20% chance of a rate increase by next September. And most of that is next year, right? It's the chances of a hike this year are still very low, but also not zero anymore. It used to be zero, but now it's not zero. But for next year, it's you know, creeping up there, where there is this tail risk and this wider distribution of potential outcomes that the market's starting to price. So you see that in things like out of the money puts on SOFR, and you know, just look at those U5 SOFR futures, and you'll see how much the out of the money stuff has moved quite significantly because of this repricing of the possibility that the Fed may actually hike.
Yeah, I just think about where we were again late last year in terms of the rate think and the Fed think, and where we've come. It's just a reminder that things can change pretty dramatically based on the data points that are there. Hey, folks, thank you so much. Have a great weekend. Really appreciate it. Bloomberg News Economics Editor Molly Smith and Bloomberg Intelligence Chief U.S. Interest Rate Strategist Ira Jersey, who I know was up early because I was listening to him on surveillance
break it down.
It was great analysis. Hey, straight ahead, we're going to stay on the U.S. labor market. We're going to check in once again with Becky Frankowitz. She's over at Manpower Group, President of North America. She's going to talk about who's hiring, what they are seeing, who is not in real time. Some of the trends might surprise you. That's coming up next. This is Bloomberg.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
We are staying on the U.S. labor market, of course, following this morning's 8:30 a.m. Wall Street Time report and update. We mentioned earlier a surprisingly stronger report, that forecast, you know, that came out versus forecast.
I mean, it's incredible.
It was strong.
Like Molly said, it's like month after month we're getting things above estimates, Carol. Mm-hmm. Like it's like economists still continue to get it wrong each month.
Yeah, and the job growth in March, we should point out, led by faster hiring in healthcare, also construction, leisure and hospitality, also strong, which has now bounced back above its pre-pandemic level. So interesting to note that. A measure of the breadth of job gains also increasing.
Hey, let's get to Becky Frankowitz for the interview. She's Chief Commercial Officer and President North America over at Manpower Group, joining us once again from Chicago. Becky, good to have you back with us. This payrolls report, did it catch you by surprise this morning?
Yeah, so I'd say March Madness rolled on this morning in today's numbers. It was a little bit of a surprise, I think, to everyone. Honestly, Tim, I was thinking we'd hit about 250, so I had a bit of a more robust perspective than consensus, but over 300 surprised me. I was also watching revisions, which you saw were really small for last month. And so that was good news. We continue to see just resilience in this labor market, you know, still recovering from some of the rebalancing we need to do post pandemic. Employers continue to hire, but what's interesting is employees are staying put as we see the quit rates truly hold. So they're no longer out there seeking that next thing at the same level they were before.
Becky, break it down. You guys have a great snapshot when it comes to different industries. I mentioned faster hiring in healthcare, construction, leisure and hospitality, back above its pre-pandemic level. Break it down though for what you guys are seeing in terms of strength, because you guys are really seeing it too in real time, and where we are still seeing weakness when it comes to the labor market.
Yeah, so real time, because we know the jobs numbers are, you know, a look in the rearview mirror. Real time, you know, we're seeing what I'm calling now a Goldilocks labor market. I mean, the demand is a bit hotter than last year. a bit cooler than last month, so we should keep an eye on that. Again, this is real-time job postings, not what we're seeing looking in the rearview mirror, and we're a bit warmer than pre-pandemic. And so the foundation of the labor market continues to be pretty solid. In terms of industries, as you mentioned, the one I'm most encouraged by is hospitality and leisure, really driven by affordable experiences. And so what does that mean? The hiring companies are Walgreens, Dollar Tree, Lowe's, Superclips, those kind of companies that are really accessible, affordable experiences for consumers. The other one, you know, construction, really pleased with the construction number. You know, construction means a startup of a lot of things positive. And the one that you didn't mention is tech, and truly looking in AI. So the AI hiring is just month over month setting new records, still at a low enough rate that you don't see it break out of the tech demand, but software developers are still the number two most in-demand job in the economy today.
Okay, they're not getting, the AI is not ruining their job yet. We've talked about that a little bit. Becky, what about areas of weakness though?
Yeah, so I tell you, there were, I'd say, three surprises today, and I'll go in order of least surprise. The women's workforce participation ticked down just a little bit, a tenth of a point. But the reason it's important, it's the first time in 4 months that happened. And then you saw overall participation go up. And I like to put numbers around it, Tim, because when you say percentage points, it's confusing to me. That's 344,000 Americans that rejoined the labor force in terms of that tick up in participation. But the women participation came down a bit. The second one we have to watch closely, which is the participation for non-high school graduates. So people without a high school degree went down 2 percentage points. Now we're talking tenths of a point in other metrics. This is 2 full percentage points. So that's a place to watch. And then finally, I'd say the one that surprised me is the composition of the household survey, where you saw the biggest increase was in part-time jobs. So full-time jobs actually went down by about 7,000 jobs, but part-time went up by about 700,000 jobs. So that tells us a couple of things. One, it says that workers are choosing to work on a way that meets their needs. Employers are responding. And it also says we're starting to see people start to put jobs together in the way they want to. And that's a big driver of that increase in workforce participation. So that's a positive. Keep an eye on that full-time number, though. I'll be watching it next month.
Interesting. Hey, one of the things on our prep call, our producer, Paul Brennan, mentioned what you've been seeing in warehouse and distribution. And I'd like to go there because it is something, whether we're talking to a real estate investor, you know, or we're just talking about, I don't know, various sectors. We talk about warehouse and distribution a lot. What are we seeing? Because you've seen some weakness from what I understand.
Yeah. So, you know, the good news this month was PMI went over 50, which we know means expansionary. Takes time to trickle through, Carol. So we didn't see that. We saw a very level, you know, it wasn't big news up or big news down. It was quite level for the month. But the thing that was interesting when you dig into the numbers, where we're starting to see demand increase, is at the intersection of tech and production. So think about, I'll give one example that we're working with now, shrink wrap. So if you're going to shrink wrap a pallet, with the equipment available today, it takes about 12 people to shrink wrap a pallet line. With AI and automation, you can do it with 2, but those 2 people actually make almost twice as much as those other 12. And so, yes, jobs will be disrupted. New jobs with higher order skills are going to be created, but we're just seeing the beginning of this. So it's not really showing up in the numbers yet.
Huh. Hey, Becky, we've talked over the past couple of years about the push-pull when it comes to who has the power, whether it's labor or whether it's the employers. And I'm wondering where you think that balance is. And I know this is certainly dependent upon industry, but in general, right now, who has the upper hand?
Yeah. So I tell you right now, we're in a little bit of a happy marriage. Hence, we don't see employers doing mass layoffs and we don't see employees leaving. And so we're in a bit of a good relationship at the present moment. But I will say, I'm not sure, Paul, if we're ever going to shift back. I'm sorry, Tim, if we're ever going to shift back to the time where employers are in the same level of control they had before, only because structurally the population has changed. We have fewer workers. We have more people retiring. We're going to need some AI to actually get to the economic growth that we need as a global economy and definitely as a U.S. economy. And so I think we won't see that tip back strongly towards the work or to the employer. We might see a little tip towards the worker. But right now, you know, we're in a bit of a balance.
Immigration. I am curious what you're seeing or what you know or what you're hearing from employers about that and the impact that that is having on the labor market.
Yeah, so you know, we all saw the article that talked about, hey, how is that showing up? Is that one of the reasons why we can't get a good read on the jobs numbers? We're having to do so many revisions. What I would say is, you know, as a company in this industry, we are pro immigration because we know we need more workers into the workforce. Now, we only hire people who are legally able to work in the country. So that's what I see. Outside of that, you know, I'm not exactly sure what's happening, but we do know and we hope that people who are coming into the country are you know, actively participating in our labor force. That would be good news for us. It may mess up all of our algorithms, but it's good news in the end.
Well, and I think we are talking legal immigration, but also that they're able to fill jobs, but not necessarily, you know, put pressure on wages, which is giving kind of the Fed some flexibility. So it's something we've been talking about. Our Rich Miller at Bloomberg had a great story about this.
The other part of this is that, look, we still have 8 million, more than 8 million jobs open. Mm-hmm. We've had this imbalance within the economy for more jobs than available for workers. And indeed, immigrants are coming to the country legally, Becky, to fill those jobs. It's taken a little bit of time post-pandemic, but it's certainly drawing people from all over the world.
Well, and that's part of the 334,000 people who have come into the workforce in terms of participation. And again, we need more workers to fuel economic growth. And to your point, there are 1.4 jobs for every unemployed American right now, 1.4. And you heard me say we're a bit warmer than pre-pandemic. Pre-pandemic, that number was 1.2 open jobs for every unemployed American. So we are having strong foundational metrics.
How do you think about that number, 1.3, 1.4 jobs available for every person who's looking essentially right now? Because there are some geographical limitations here. We had a guest on earlier this week who I asked about that, and she said, look, you're not gonna move to Idaho for a job if you're living in New York. You're not gonna move across the country for a minimum wage job. How should we look at that type of data given there are geographical limitations here?
Yeah, there are geographical limitations. And I think balancing part of that, now not all of that, but part of that is we continue to see an increase in remote working, particularly in the tech sector. 41% of the jobs posted today can be done fully remote. It's 16% for the overall economy. Okay. You said, what does 16% mean? It was probably 11% pre-pandemic. So we've seen an actual increase outside of tech as well. But there are geographical limitations, but increasingly with remote and flexibility, people have access to those jobs. And we're seeing the population, as you well know, shift out of some of these big cities. And that's giving these other states an opportunity to have some talent within their borders.
Hey, real quickly, 20 seconds. Are companies holding on to workers, labor hoarding like they used to, or they feel more comfortable going a little bit leaner and hiring as they need? Real quickly.
Yeah, they're still holding on to workers and still hiring, skewing towards permanent workers versus temps. There's still that pandemic paranoia hangover.
Interesting.
All right.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
All right, Becky, thank you so much. Have a great weekend. Becky Frankowitz, Chief Commercial Officer, President North America over at Manpower Group, joining us from Chicago.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Well, later this month, something's going to happen that won't happen again for a few years. And no, I'm not talking about next week's total solar eclipse.
Okay, what are you talking
about?
Okay,
I'm talking about the Bitcoin halving, or halvening, as it's sometimes referred to. If you have no idea what I'm talking about, you're in good company. A lot of people don't know what this is. And we've also got the perfect person to explain what's going on. David Pann is Bloomberg News crypto and blockchain companies reporter. He joins us here in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. So David, this is not the first time there's been a halving or a halvening. explain what's set to happen, if all things go according to plan, later this month with Bitcoin.
Okay, so the halving is, it happens every 4 years. So the first halving took place in 2012. So it was pre-programmed in the Bitcoin blockchain. So basically what happens is that, you know, the new supply of Bitcoin released from the blockchain will be cut in half. So that has been the main revenue source for Bitcoin mining companies. So the amount of Bitcoin will be cut after this halving, which will happen later this month, is going to be worth about $10 billion in revenue for in annual revenue for the miners.
In a haircut, you mean? In other words, they're going to get less revenue, right?
Yes, like $10 billion a year.
Why does this happen? Why does it have to happen?
So the anonymous creator of Bitcoin used this mechanism to actually maintain the hard cap of 21 million tokens for Bitcoin. That's why a lot of people are advocating for the cryptocurrency, because it's not inflationary, because there's a hard cap.
It's a fixed supply, right?
Exactly.
So I guess my question is, this is about, who does this affect more? Does it affect more the miners, or does it affect potentially the price of Bitcoin?
Correct. So I think there's going to be very significant negative impact for the mining companies, because, you know,
many of which are publicly traded.
Exactly. So the combined market cap for the top 14 publicly traded Bitcoin mining companies is worth about $20 billion, according to JP Morgan's recent report. So then the impact on the market will be more or less positive, because it has been driving the narrative that it will actually cut the supply of the new Bitcoin, right? And then that will push the price higher.
Okay, so David, let's take a big step back and just talk a little bit about how Bitcoin is mined. For people mm-hmm. who aren't familiar with it, there are these publicly traded companies that have operations that use energy-intensive computers to solve equations. And as a reward for solving those equations correctly, they're rewarded Bitcoin, right?
Right.
Okay.
So they are using specialized computers manufactured by some like a really large Chinese companies based out of Asia. It wasn't always like this. At first, when Bitcoin just came out, people can just mine this cryptocurrency by their PCs. But now we have seen a remarkable industrialization of the mm-hmm. you know, of the process. We have the specialized computers manufactured by multi-billion dollar Chinese companies, and then we have all of these publicly traded companies like Marathon Digital Holdings and Riot Platforms. They are setting up like acres of, you know, mining farms. So they're using containers, like, you know, the specialized computers, they are stacked on top of each other. Like millions of these mining machines are running 24/7.
Well, what happened the last time we saw halving and halvening in terms of the value of Bitcoin and just the market overall and the marketplace overall? And I realized things changed dramatically, or they have changed from the last time around. But what happened last time around?
So, you know, like, I think it is one thing that the Bitcoin miners have a control over the supply of the Bitcoin. There's another thing that has been happening, which is like it tends to correlate with other positive events for the market. For example, in 2020, we had this remarkable surge in Bitcoin prices because of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. People were bored and people started trading, paying more attention to Bitcoin.
Right.
And then even back in 2016, which is probably like two cycles ago, and that happened right before the 2017 ICO boom, like where a lot of people actually started noticing all these cryptocurrencies, including Bitcoin.
ICOs being initial coin offerings.
Right.
Yes.
Okay, so David, before we let you go, I'm curious about what this means for, I don't know, I have a couple different questions. If the next halving is in 2028, mm-hmm. like, what's your prediction about what we're going to be talking about then? I mean, are we still going to be talking about Bitcoin the way we're talking about it now?
Yes, I think so. The Bitcoin market will always exist. And I think that the big question will be where the miners are going to go, because the main business for them is mine the coins.
Right.
And then now the coins will be, you know, will be disappear.
At what point does it become not worth it for them to mine?
So by the time of 2140, so that will be the time essentially the blockchain would, you know, stop releasing all these new coins.
The year 2140.
The year of 2140.
Well, I'm not going to be around that. Although maybe I will.
You never know. They're working on longevity stuff right now. No, it's just kind of interesting. So bottom line, why do we care?
We care because it has the impact on the market. You know, it's actually driving a narrative that, you know, the supply of Bitcoin will be reduced and therefore the prices will be pushed up even further on top of the rally that we already have. And then the other thing will be...
It's just supply demand. It's just basic, but go
exactly.
ahead.
Exactly. and the other big thing will be the fate of these mining companies.
Yeah.
What they're going to do, where they're going to transition, are they going to transition out of this business?
Right.
Are they going to diversify into like HPC, high performing computing services for AI companies? Right. We don't know. So.
Interesting.
Yeah. I will say Marathon Digital down more than 21% so far this year. It's a $5 billion market cap company. And then Riot Platforms, the Bitcoin mining company, down 34% so far this year. They've got a market cap of about $2.6 billion.
I just feel like everything that goes on in the Bitcoin or digital coin space, it just, you know, get answers on some things but raises questions on
Never
others.
A dull moment.
Never a dull moment.
By the way, David Pan is the guy to ask questions too if you have them.
I know, you say it's a must read.
Oh yeah, he's a must read when it comes to everything when you're talking mining and Bitcoin. So,
all right, David.
Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
David Pan, Bloomberg News crypto and blockchain companies reporter, joining us here in studio.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, we got about just under, 14 and a half minutes, let's call it, until we wrap up the Friday trading session and wrap up the trading week. Charlie, of course, just breaking down the numbers. We're up more than 1% on both the S&P and the NASDAQ 100. So very different tone in today's trade. As we said, good news was good news for the equity trade, which hasn't always been the case. Good economic news has often meant expectations that higher rates are going to stick around for longer. And there were concerns about what that meant for valuations in some of the names on the equity market and put pressure.
It does look like, Carol,
what?
That we're actually going to get a down week.
Yeah, because the week has not been great.
In 2024, it's kind of rare. We have not had many weeks to the downside. The vast majority of the time, stocks have moved higher. And actually, our next guest says that after the run-up that we've seen since October, he wouldn't be surprised to see a little bit of a pullback in the near future. Let's drive to the close with Greg Halter, Director of Research at Carnegie Investment Council. They've got around $4 billion in assets under management. Greg joining us from Cleveland. Greg, how are you?
Doing fine, and thank you for having me back.
Yeah, it's good to have you back. Hey, I want to talk a little bit about this potential pullback that we might see in the near future. What are you looking at right now?
Well, I guess if you look at history, the last two quarters that have been completed were both up double digits. I believe that's only happened 8 times since 1950. So what that has meant 1 year out is that the stock market is higher. Now, of course, do we go straight up? We definitely don't. So we could see some pullback or maybe even a rotation in some of the names, but I do think the market over the next year will be higher.
Because why?
I believe that the companies are generating a lot of cash, lots of free cash flow that's going towards dividends and also importantly share repurchase. I believe that there were some thoughts that the share repurchase side would be dented due to the tax that was put in place. That has not been the case. We may be on a record pace, so that'll help your earnings per share side of things. And I just think business is good, so these companies will generate some favorable earnings growth.
What about geopolitical concerns? We saw a little bit, I guess we can call it a little bit of a sell-off, but relative to what we've seen lately, it was a pretty big sell-off yesterday over an increase in oil prices, some hawkish commentary from Neil Kashkari, who's not a voting member of the Fed this year, and also some comments. I think people had geopolitical concerns yesterday that sent the price of oil higher after we heard from Benjamin Netanyahu. What about geopolitics playing into this?
It's definitely a factor. I mean, we at Carnegie don't invest for a week or a month. I mean, it's more of a long-term focus. So yes, are we concerned? Do we pay attention? We certainly do. But over the long term, and if you look at the history of the stock market, the market has been able to put these things in its back pocket, take it with stride, and move higher over time. Now, again, depending on the severity and so forth, that always can make a difference. But we think over time, over the long term, you do see these things kind of get put to the side. I think because of the innovative nature and the fact that companies are able to continually, it seems like, raise their margins.
Hey, listen, what's really great is when someone like yourself who is managing money longer term, get it, but you do think about some of the individual equity names and you're willing to share what you think might be a good investment at this point. So I'd love to go through some of the names. Genuine Parts Company is one of the names that you are interested in and thinking about as a stock for the longer term. Stock is up about 8%. Again, this is, you know, auto parts, replacement parts. What's the thinking? Is this that people, because rates are higher, don't want to go out and buy a car, so they're going to take care of their existing car, which is one of the folks. I'm one of those folks.
Well, it is a global business. The auto is 55 or 60, and this is the Napa Auto Stars that you may have seen in all parts of the country and then obviously international as well. They compete with AutoZone and O'Reilly, which have done very well. Our thought process there is that they kind of stumbled a bit last year in the Napa business. They have replaced management. We think they get this right. On top of that, they have an excellent, excellent industrial parts distribution business called Motion Industries, which has margins that are better than peer. Both of these businesses throw off tremendous free cash flow. Genuine Parts is in the throes of spending additionally on some CapEx that will improve their efficiencies. They acquired the number three player in the industrial distribution business, and they were number one. So now they even have a stronger presence there. Again, they throw off a lot of cash. They've used that cash to raise the dividend for 68 consecutive years. Not many companies can say that. So it's a steady eddy, if you will. And if they get a few things right, we think this at 14 or 15 times earnings could be quite interesting in this market for sure.
Hey, what about Hershey? Down, well, only up about 4% so far this year, underperforming the S&P 500. Also, the cocoa prices should be an issue for this company. Why are you optimistic about Hershey?
Well, it's the cheapest valuation on a relative basis it's been in years. Definitely we were concerned about cocoa. I coined a phrase last year called the chip ripper for all the semiconductor chip companies. This is the chocolate chip ripper, if you will, given what's going on with cocoa going from 2000 to 10. But, yeah. You know, this company's been around for a long time. They do hedge. I think they're in a good position there. Relative to cocoa, you know, unless it just goes to 20 or 50,000, which I don't see happening. They do have an iconic brand. They are able to get price. I think that's what people are worried about, and that's hence the sell-off. But if you look at the stock chart, it's actually kind of found a floor here over the last few months. And I think that's investors like us saying it's gotten to a point where this is more attractive than it's been in years. And again, these are candies, chocolates. People are going to continue to buy them.
Yeah, it's interesting because actually Morgan Stanley lowered their price target on Hershey to 170 a share from 183. Stock right now at about 193 or just below 194 a share. And they're a little concerned and they see the EPS falling by about 5% year over year due to that rise in cocoa prices, as you said, up, 90% over the last 2 months and up 125% year to date. But you think at least in the near, you're a longer term investor. So even if there is some pressure this year, next year, you still think it's an interesting buy right now.
We certainly do. Again, we invest for the long term. We love when we get these buying opportunities in these excellent, well-managed companies that have great balance sheets and excellent free cash flow. You don't get many opportunities to buy good companies like this, and this is when you take advantage of them.
One other name too that I feel like I get it, especially consider some of the geopolitical concerns that are around, is Lockheed Martin. It's a little changed on the year right now. You've got a PE of about 13.68, just below 14, a forward-looking PE of just below 18. Is it the geopolitical? It's interesting. It used to be, right, we used to think Republicans spend on defense and Democrats don't, but now we know that's not been the case for a long, long time. But is it geopolitical that, you know, we're going to need weapons, unfortunately?
There's no doubt that's got to play into this. You know, I think they've kind of stubbed their toe, if you will, a bit with the F-35. Mm-hmm. You know, if they get those issues behind them, they've got a huge backlog. It's into the billions, multi-billions. So they certainly have the revenues out there, the orders out there. It's just converting that into margins and profits. Historically, they have done that. Obviously, they're beholden to the budget in the U.S. and the pluses and minuses of that. And of course, we've got an election year, so there's all kinds of thinking, well, what's going to go on? But you're right, the stock hasn't done much over the last year or 18 months. We think, again, this is an excellent opportunity for what's been a very good capital allocator over the years, if not decades, in terms of dividends and share repurchase and very wise moves in terms of CapEx to meet the internal needs that the company has.
Another company on your radar is Lowe's. Interested in the company, given that we actually saw some hiring in construction earlier today from the most recent payrolls report. Why would you pick Lowe's over Home Depot?
Great question. We obviously know Home Depot as well and have some ownership in that as well. But our selection, if you will, is Lowe's. We think that with the not so new management there, but the management is really trying and really targeting to get its margins to Home Depot's levels. And again, not in one fell swoop, but over time, if they can do that and continue to do what they're doing in terms of their cash generation, which, you know, they're not building new stores, so that cash is going to dividends and a big share repurchase program. If they can continue to improve their operations internally and get those margins up 10, 20, 50 basis points a year, get closer to Home Depot, we think this could certainly trade above the current valuation levels.
Hey, one other area, and I'm thinking about specifically Visa and MasterCard. You like this area as well. Is that because, unfortunately, consumers continue to spend, or what's the thinking here?
Yes, and this is also a global business, not just mm-hmm. U.S., but, you know, it's a duopoly. People hate to say that, but it truly is. You know, they've That's got a massive share in that credit card processing space. They are still able to raise price despite what just happened this week or last week in terms of the big settlement they had. You know, they're really where the rails are run for all the credit card purchases. And as long as spending continues, we think Visa and MasterCard stand to benefit. And the valuations are not stretched at this level, certainly relative to their own historic
norms. So MasterCard with a 38 PE, forward 33, you feel pretty comfortable with that real quickly? And PE on Visa is about 30, almost 32.
Yep, they're high on that basis, but relative to where the company's traded over time, we don't think it's all that crazy high. We like it. We like their growth.
All right. Well, really appreciate being able to talk some names with you. Greg, thank you so much. Have a great and safe weekend. Greg Halter, Director of Research at Carnegie Investment Counsel. They've got about $4 billion in assets under management. And he was joining us from Cleveland, Ohio.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. On Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Talk
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.